9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Coming up on the Free For All, Michael Bloomberg. Will he or won't he mount an independent bid for the White House? Mara Gay joins us to talk about Bloomberg's potential run. Also, from Toronto, Ben Cohen checks in from the NBA All-Star Game. And Brian Costa, sports columnist, talks about the shorts controversy. That's right, shorts in pro golf.
You're listening to Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hi, this is Jason Gay, and you are listening to the WSJ Free For All. And I am alone and solo today. Jim Trusmi is taking a day off after a long Super Bowl arduous weekend for Jim. I, too, was at the Super Bowl, but I don't have a day off today. What I do have in front of me, I am calling in from home because I do have a cold given to me by one of my small children. One of the hazards, of course, of small children is that they are disease-carrying wombats, and so you're sick for about a third of your life once the kids enter the picture. But I'm sitting at my dining room table, and I'm looking. Tanya, can you weigh in here? I'm looking at my dining room table, and I have a Valentine's Day flower arrangement, which I ordered from my wife through the employee discount store.
Ooh, okay. Okay, and how did that work out?
This is our producer, Tanya. Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, the flowers look fine. I mean, they'll be fine, hopefully. But do I really come off as a cheapskate ordering my wife Valentine's Day flowers from the employee discount store? I mean, they were 40% off. A deal's a deal.
A deal is a deal. I would hope that she would understand. I mean, that's actually good for the employee discount store. That's, you usually don't get 40%.
Right? Yeah, usually it's like 0.15% off.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, this was a... And the flowers do look, life-wise, they might have 40% off, too. But we'll see. As long as they can last until she comes home from work today, I think I'm golden.
It's all about the presentation.
That's right. Well, we have a pretty wide-ranging show today, which I'm excited about. Joining us first will be Mara Gay to talk about the Michael Bloomberg run, the potential Michael Bloomberg run for president. We'll also be joined by Ben Cohen, who is up in frozen Toronto. If you can believe that New York is a much balmier place than Toronto, you'll feel sympathy for Ben Cohen today, who's up at the All-Star Weekend there. And then lastly, we'll be joined by Brian Costa, who is a tremendous columnist for the Journal, writes about baseball, but also has recently started to foray into the world of golf and wrote a very interesting story this week about golf wrestling with the sartorial question of should men wear shorts. But let's start with Mara. And just to, introduce you, Mara, I mean, you cover City Hall for the Wall Street Journal, city politics,
right,
but a whole range of things. And tell me a little bit about how you got started with the Journal.
Sure. It's been a little bit of a wild ride. I actually started as a stringer, which most people call a freelancer, a few years ago.
Yeah.
And then the Daily News actually hired me full time. So I covered the 2013 mayoral campaign and Michael Bloomberg last year in office there. And then the Wall Street Journal hired me back. So I've been there for a couple of years full time now. And you know, I cover City Hall, which means Mayor de Blasio, but also Mayor Bloomberg, former Mayor Bloomberg, and any other polls that happen to be running through town.
What are the hours like for you, for your job?
It depends. It really depends on what's going on. I think on a busy day, or especially during a campaign, for example, we might be working from 6, 7 in the morning until midnight. Usually we try and get out of here around 7 p.m., but there's a lot of running around City Hall.
And you have something of a partner in crime with Josh. Josh, it's Dawsey.
My work husband. Yeah, Josh is in South Carolina right now. He's on the Donald Trump campaign trail, so he's thoroughly missed here at City Hall. But he and I like to team up. We have a good time. And if you follow along his tweet, JDawsey1, it's really almost as entertaining as Donald Trump himself. So.
Now, do you feel envious or sorry for him off on the Trump campaign?
Well, from a weather perspective, I'm a little bit jealous of South Carolina right now. But no, to be honest, I used to cover national politics, and I'm very happy here at City Hall. We have, you know, everything from the most serious issues of affordable housing and stop and frisk to Groundhog Day. You know, will the groundhog survive?
Yes, so and the mayor did not kill the groundhog this year, which is great news.
Nope. Well, the mayor also didn't go to the ceremony, so that's...
Oh, well, that there helped. You go. So that's why no groundhogs were killed.
Exactly.
Well, you mentioned the fact that, you know, city politics is always lively, but here you have national politics once again intruding into city politics in that, you know, our three-term mayor, ex-mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, is once more mulling a presidential bid. Now, this has come up before. He's mulled this in the past. It's never amounted to an actual candidacy, but, you know, given the circumstances of the, you know, the volatility and the in both sides of the aisle, both Republican and Democratic races, he seems to be a little bit more serious this time around. And, you know, from what you're able to glean, I mean, you know, a lot of people who worked with him, worked around him, worked near him. Do you sense a new seriousness to this?
You know, I do. I mean, this float, we call it a float in politics, right? When you kind of put some feelers out there and see how people might react if you were to actually run. This float has happened before, right? But there is kind of a new sense of seriousness. I feel like, you know, you talk to people who've covered the mayor for a long time, they feel it. People who work for him, they feel the seriousness as well. I think kind of what we're dealing with is a perfect storm, a brewing perfect storm, if you will, of different factors that are kind of coming together to create a moment and an opening for the former mayor. And I think, you know, they're still trying to ascertain if he would have a real shot of winning.
Yes.
Because they don't want to do this as just, they don't, you know, Mr. Bloomberg and his advisors don't see this as just running to run. They would really want to win. But but really, there are a lot of factors coming together and making them think, well, maybe this is our shot. And that's a field that they see as very weak of candidates. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, frankly, I think this is probably, I think his birthday is maybe today, Bloomberg, but he's getting older, and I think this is really, he sees this as his chance, his moment.
Well, and also, he can't be too far removed from city politics. He can't, you know, suddenly be 8 or 12 years removed from city politics and be a viable national candidate. He still, you know, has something to trade on here because he's not that far out of office.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. I mean, he has actually, in the tradition of former presidents, really, Mayor Bloomberg has really tried to stay out of the fray of city politics. He really hasn't weighed in on Mayor de Blasio's tenure.
Right.
His aides sometimes are chomping at the bit
for him.
And defend his legacy, but it's something that he's really discouraged.
So if it is a float, and it is sort of, you know, putting the finger to the wind and, you know, assessing public reaction. Do you have any feel for that? I mean, I'm just judging from, you know, looking at news coverage and social media and so on that, you know, there's sort of this shrug saying, yeah, of course, you know, Bloomberg makes some rational sense and, you know, he's not going to be out there, you know, cursing and berating people, at least not publicly. You know, I don't get the sense of some sort of like public groundswell behind this, at least not yet. Do you have any vibe for what the reaction's been?
Well, I think that's kind of a $1 million question, right? This is
$1 billion question, possibly.
Well, it is. It's a potentially $1 billion question. Exactly. I mean, he has a figure in New York that is larger than life. And although he is known in many quarters, frankly, his national polling is there's just a lot of question marks about how he would do nationally. It's the same issues that have always been there. He's got Wall Street roots. He is pro-choice. He's pro-gun control. Some southern states, you know, his last year in office when Bloomberg was trying to get a soda ban passed, or not a soda ban, but a ban on large sodas, right? So there were southern states in the country, Georgia, for example, Mississippi, that actually adopted legislation that they described as the anti-Bloomberg legislation, preventing localities from actually doing the same thing. So there are a lot of questions about his national appeal.
You know, there's this consensus opinion out there that, you know, the best scenario for him is, you know, a Donald Trump or Ted Cruz nomination from the GOP, and that you could get it, and then a Sanders uprising. You know, we've seen indications of that, but a Bernie Sanders, a much more realistic chance of him getting the nomination, which, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, sort of clears this, you know, this road for Bloomberg as a, you know, quote unquote, establishment candidate, someone who would appeal to significant donors, who would appeal to Wall Street, who would appeal to this, you know, presumed, you know, quiet majority of people who would like a more centrist style candidate. Is that a fair assessment of what their thinking is?
You know, I don't want to overstate. I haven't been sitting in meetings with them. They've been very hush hush about the whole thing, but I do talk to them fairly often, and I actually don't think it's quite as cut and dry as that. I think that they see Hillary Clinton as potentially very weak, and Ted Cruz is potentially very divisive as well, and in some way Rubio too. So when you look at that field of candidates, you know, they do want to wait as long as possible to see kind of who's emerging and where the momentum is. But I wouldn't rule out a Bloomberg run simply because you have a certain specific combination of candidates. I actually think that the mayor's biggest challenge in making this successful is really, to my mind, that the momentum right now in this cycle so far seems to be around populist candidates.
Yes.
That would describe both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, right?
Yes.
Who are speaking to real anger of a lot of Americans, many of them white, lower middle class men, who feel that they've been left out. And I think that Mayor Bloomberg might have a little bit of trouble speaking to that group. The only question is, you know, how much of that is the primary and how much of that is really describes the larger electorate?
You know, were he to become a candidate, I'm curious from what you've seen, you know, as watched him, you know, move around the city and just, you know, do the sort of duties of a public servant. It never seemed that Bloomberg was somebody who was terribly interested nor inclined to do the kinds of, you know, I don't know, you know, press grooming and you know, baby kissing that we typically assign to politicians. Now, we've seen a lot of things in this election thus far that, you know, have upended reasonable expectations of national political candidates. Is that any more? I guess those would be treated in the past as weaknesses for Bloomberg, that he's not necessarily a retail politician. But is that even an issue in 2016?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you're absolutely right. I actually asked one of his advisors about that handicap, so to speak, the other day. And, you know, the advisor said, hey, listen, I hear you, but if he's going to run, if he makes that decision, he'll be all in. And this is a man who won election in New York 3 times. So. Yeah. It may not, you know, he may not be the most natural retail politician on earth, certainly, but he does kind of know what he's doing.
Yeah.
And I would also say that, you know, if you look at Donald Trump rallies and if you talk to Josh Dossie, for example, I mean, that's a guy who, like you said, doesn't have much experience, traditional experience in politics in that way. But people are responding to him. And I think that, you know, Michael Bloomberg, a lot of New Yorkers even said, well, I disagree with him, but, you know, at least he says it like it is. And I think that might actually have some appeal in this season, especially because he does have, you know, hit $38 billion of his own dollars. So he has a sense of independence that I think a lot of voters are looking for right now. So, look, we've seen, you know, far wilder things than Michael Bloomberg run.
When does the decision have to happen here? You know, we, again, sort of all bets are off because the calendar is going to be very different this year, the way the nomination process is going to work, especially in the Republican side. It seems like it's going to take a while, but, you know, any sense of what the calendar will be?
Sure. Yeah. You know, yes. His advisors want to make a decision. They want him to make a decision by March, the beginning of March. And the reason is twofold. One is that that's when the Super Tuesday primary is going to happen, March 1st. So they're going to get a much better sense of how Hillary Clinton is doing, for example, and kind of feel that out. But the other issue is very practical, which is that if he were to run as an independent candidate, he would need to get on the ballot in all 50 states.
Yes.
That
yes.
process is something I'm looking into, something the campaign.
I imagine that's already underway, don't you think, probably?
It's already out of the way.
Underway. That there are people
absolutely.
Who are, you know, well into this.
Absolutely underway. But I can tell you, I've spoken to Secretary of State, you know, their kind of offices in a number of states so far, trying to get a sense of what he would have to do. And there are some incredibly arcane rules.
Yeah,
he would
sure.
have to collect 178,000 signatures in California by August. He'd have to get 80,000 signatures in Texas by May. And then there are all kinds of other rules that, frankly, these very partisan offices often create to dissuade exactly this phenomenon from taking place, because they're creatures of the two parties.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, you know, the first thing you learn about running for president probably is that it's very hard to run for president. I mean, there are all these kinds of logistical roadblocks in the way.
Well, it's funny because, you know, as I've been calling these offices, just trying to get information about, you know, well, how would I get on the ballot in Alaska as an independent party candidate? There are a lot of questions among these bureaucrats that, well, gee, I've never gotten that question before. And, you know, a lot of, I have to get back to you on that. I have no idea, but they probably all think I'm running for president.
Just a last question for you, which is that, you know, were he to enter the race, and if you can imagine him in a debate type scenario as the Ross Perot or John Anderson many years ago, how does he change the conversation? You know, you imagine him in a circumstance where it's Donald Trump, Michael Bloomberg, and Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. What's that dynamic like? What does Bloomberg add?
Well, it's hard to know what the dynamic is like, although I think it would be really entertaining to watch, frankly. But I do think that Bloomberg, if he's going to be successful, and this is something that one of his aides and I were talking about the other day, he would really need to have a message of jobs. He could come out there and say, you know, look, I ran this, you know, multi-billion-dollar company successfully. I ran the biggest city in the world successfully, and I created jobs. And good jobs. And here's how I'm going to do it for you. And he, you know, he can also talk, quite frankly, about, you know, the environment, which he has a record on. He's able to talk about international issues in a way that some of the other candidates actually can't, which is one of the ironies of, you know, being mayor of New York City. In some ways, you're the mayor of a small town.
Yeah.
It can function like that when you look at Groundhog Day. In other ways, we have, you know, heads of state that come to City Hall regularly.
Yeah. I have to wonder, Mara, if he's just a little bit rusty, you know, in the same way of like an athlete mounting a comeback that, you know, this is a guy who, you know, the third time around when he ran for election, you know, had a very, very close race with a candidate, Bill Thompson, that, you know, no one expected to be in it. And, you know, the grind of this, I mean, it's been a while since he's been out there doing all this.
It has. So when the mayor left office, he said he was going to focus on philanthropy. Then he went back to helm his company instead. A lot of, you know, City Hall chatter is, well, maybe he's bored. You know, this is the man who ran New York City for a dozen years. So he definitely has, I think, a lot of stamina. He also has a ready stable of aides to jump in for him who are very loyal to him and very good at what they do. And including Hillary Clinton's former strategist. And so I think, you know, I wouldn't underestimate that team, frankly. I wouldn't underestimate the mayor's interest in this, something he's wanted for a long time. But I also would say that it'll be interesting to see how Bloomberg plays nationally, because, you know, the criticism was he was tone deaf to a lot of New Yorkers. And already we've seen, you know, the first interview that he gave to the Financial Times, and nothing against the Financial Times, but we're talking about a British newspaper.
It's not like going on The View.
It's not like going, you know, and so we're thinking to ourselves, well, maybe they still don't get it, but let's just have to wait and see.
absolutely. Mara, thank you very much for your time. Just to clarify, you know, we aren't brother and sister. We might be distant cousins. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever been asked this. I've been asked it. You know, we need to look into this at some point.
Many times, but no nepotism at work that we're aware of.
I wish I could claim credit for having you as my sister. I mean, gosh, I mean, you're the star reporter. You're going to make sure to follow Mara and Josh, the best tandem working the city right now, and Donald Trump, and maybe Bloomberg 2016. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
This message is brought to you by Nuveen. Nuveen has provided investment excellence for 125 years. A lot has changed, but one thing that remains constant, including the different types of durable income and portfolios, can help investors meet their goals. With expertise across income and alternatives, Nuveen continues to expand its capabilities while maintaining its legacy as a leading investment manager. Visit Nuveen.com to learn more. Investing involves risk. Loss of principal is possible.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Veronica Dagger. Catch me midweek every week on Watching Your Wealth, where you learn all you need to know about building your wealth and protecting your money. Check us out at WSJ.com/podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at WSJ Podcasts and become a subscriber on iTunes.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Now on the line from the beautiful city of Toronto, which I believe is quite cold right now. Could I get a Fahrenheit reading from you, Ben Cohen?
72 and sunny. I don't know what you're talking about.
Ben Cohen is up at the NBA All-Star Game, and last year the NBA All-Star Game was in New York City, so I could witness its glories firsthand. And boy, let me tell you, it was whatever electricity is, it was the opposite of that. It's not much of a live event anymore, and yet you can't help but sort of be drawn to it. There are cool parties. The NBA has a lot of interesting superstars right now. Ben, describe the vibe around the All-Star Game, because the first thing everyone does about the NBA All-Star Game is sort of say like it's stupid and meaningless and they should get rid of it. And yet everyone still kind of pays attention to it these days, at least.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like an extended party or sort of like convention for the NBA. I mean, what happens on Saturday night and Sunday night isn't really important, but I guess it's just sort of a place where the entire league comes together in the middle of the season and talks about how amazing the Warriors are.
And there are always trade rumors, and you know, that's the other thing that happens is, you know, someone gooses some sort of rumor. It seems like there are a lot of Dwight Howard rumors flying around at the moment, whether or not they have any truth, unknown. If you could follow around any all-star for the weekend, and I mean 24/7, who would it be?
Kobe.
Kobe, really? Why?
Yeah, I think that he is the marquee attraction of this all-star game. In fact, you know, there actually is someone following Kobe. I saw him this morning, and he has a documentary crew filming him at all times, just following him around. So there's like a boom mic over his shoulder at all times. So
he's already made a documentary. You know, he's making another documentary about his life.
He already made a documentary, but now he's making a sequel, and he's already had Spike Lee make a documentary about him. So
that's right. This is at least two documentaries,
the Kobe trilogy. But I think he's sort of unlike any NBA player right now, which is that
this is his swan song. We should clarify that this is Kobe Bryant's last season. This is his last All-Star game. There was some debate as to whether or not he even deserved to be on this All-Star team, but obviously, you know, it's a career achievement for him, one of the great icons of NBA history, and you know, he'll be the center of attention all weekend.
And he already is. And part of it is that, you know, it's his last one, and he's one of the greatest players of all time. But he's also unlike any player in that he's incredibly blunt. He doesn't care what people think about him or what he says anymore. He'll be honest, which you don't really see in stars anymore. And he just comes with such star power. I mean, half of the players in the game grew up idolizing him, and now they're playing with him. I just think he's the most interesting guy. I mean, you know, there's, of course, LeBron and Steph Curry. This is probably Curry's coming out party as the face of the league. He was, you know, obviously a huge player last year. He started the All-Star game. He won the three-point contest, but he hadn't won a title. He hadn't won the MVP. So much has changed in the last year. But for me, it's still Kobe. I mean, I just think he's so fascinating as a figure that if you were to follow him around, I mean, imagine the story you'd get from following him around for 24 hours. It could keep you going for years.
Yeah, that's true. Now, clarify for me what Aubrey Graham's role is in all this. If he is the unofficial mayor of this, you know, he is a Toronto resident. We're speaking of the great Drake, of course. Is he official or unofficial in terms of his welcoming role here?
Well, his official title is coach of the NBA celebrity game tonight. I don't know if you knew that. I mean, he's everywhere. I mean, I look on Instagram and he's playing ping pong with Reggie Miller and Curry. Yeah. I'm sure he'll just be, you know, around. I'm actually surprised that he let the temperature drop to 0 degrees. I thought he had more control of Toronto than that these days.
Is he too much of a super fan at this point to have any sort of strong Raptors connection? I mean, he has had, you know, his Raptors moment. He's not a part owner. Is he a part owner?
I think his technical title is global ambassador, and I'm not making that up. I think that's what it actually is. Right.
But he's by far the most high-profile Toronto Raptors fan, and yet he's also always on the road, and you see him at Clippers games, you see him at Warriors games, you see him at Knicks games. I mean, this guy will take in a game in any American or Canadian city. Do you think he needs to lock it down a little bit more for the Raptors and be more of a super fan for them?
Well, I think he definitely has his Raptors credentials in tow. I mean, you know, they're really good this year. Like, they're the second best team in the East.
Yeah.
You might make an argument that they've been more stable as the best team in the East over Cleveland. And if they play them, if they play the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Final, they might give them a run. And I think that, you know, of course, if that were to happen, you know, Drake's going to be courtside every day in Toronto. But, you know, I don't blame him for not staying in Toronto from December to February to watch every Raptors game. I mean, I would be in L.A. and San Francisco, too.
Okay, so a couple quick all-star game questions. This notion that comes up every once in a while of a one-on-one contest, I love everyone likes to write a story about this, but it just will never happen for a million reasons, primarily because no one wants to be embarrassed or injured, right?
Right. I mean, these guys don't – and also they would play hard, and they don't want to play hard. Like, you can look at the All-Star game for evidence of that. Like, they would definitely play harder in a one-on-one than they do in the All-Star game.
Yeah, yeah. And then the game itself, is there anything you can do within the structure of it or the stakes of it to make it better, or should we just kind of be like, hey, it's actually really fun to watch Russell Westbrook try to score 50 and, you know, Boogie Cousins, monster dunks, and all that kind of stuff?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything you can do to make the game actually entertaining because, you know, what makes a game great are the stakes of whatever that game is, and there are obviously no stakes of the All-Star game, nor should there be. Like, you shouldn't determine home field advantage or home court advantage in the finals with this All-Star game. I mean, I guess the one thing you could do is, like, maybe you can add, like, a four-point line in the All-Star game or a five-point line that always gets talked about for regular competition. It could be fun to watch Steph Curry throw up half-court shots, which, you know, honestly, he might do on Sunday anyway, and he probably will make them. But, you know, the All-Star game is kind of underrated in that, like, the last 3 or 4 minutes of the game, you have the biggest stars on the planet on the court, and that's
kind
when they're
going for it.
And if it's a close game, they all want to win the game and, like, take a big shot to win the game.
Yeah.
Like, if you remember a couple of years ago, Kobe and LeBron were jawing back and forth at each other, and like Kobe and LeBron have never played in a finals. Like, that's the closest that they've come to, like, the entire world watching one of their games and going back and forth. So sometimes you get one of those moments.
Yeah. Ben, Adam Silver, you know, what are the sort of big announcements that might come out of this weekend? There was some talk that the NBA might, you know, throw up something with regard to the intentional fouling rule. Anything else that we might get from the commissioner?
Unless he's going to step aside and let Drake become the honorary commissioner for a day. I don't think so. I think usually the big changes come from the Board of Governor meetings in October and April and then in the summer. I don't think there are usually big announcements that come now. But the intentional fouling thing is interesting. Like, can you make that change in the middle of a season?
Wow, that's a really good question. Yeah, sure.
I don't know. Usually it's sort of – usually his press conference on Saturday night of All-Star Weekend is kind of a State of the Union type deal.
Yes.
more so than anything else he does over the course of the season. So I don't really expect huge news. I mean, I think the biggest news happened this morning at this tech summit that they do every year, in which he talked to a hologram of James Naismith for like 5 minutes on the stage. So that was, you know, something. I think that might be more exciting than what he says tomorrow night.
The Knicks traded for a hologram of Andrea Bargnani a couple years ago, so I don't know why people are just so jazzed up about this Naismith thing.
It's, I know, and they paid $5 million too. So,
all right, Benjamin, don't get cold out there. Are you going to the GQ party or any cool parties?
I'm not. I'm going to stay in my room where it is 70 degrees right now. I might bump it down to like 68 tonight. It's going to get crazy. I'm not really sure yet, though.
GQ has Future. I mean, I saw Future recently. It's a great show. You should get in there.
Who you got in the All-Star game, Jason?
I like the South. That's an All-Star game joke. Thank you, Ben Cohen from Toronto. Coming up next, we'll talk to Brian Costa about golf and pants and shorts.
Hi, I'm Paul Vini.
I'm Steve Grosser.
And this is the promo where we tell you how badly you're going to feel if you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast. You are going to feel worse than a sad trader on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Worse than a Kardashian without hair care products.
Okay, Paul, I think we get the picture.
Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Joining me is Wall Street Journal sports writer, columnist Brian Costa. Brian, before we get into the topic matter, I want to just ask you, you know, you're a married guy, kids. Am I a cheapskate to buy my wife Valentine's Day flowers with the employee discount?
There's an employee discount?
Yeah, there's an employee discount. And I got 40% off Valentine's flowers.
Oh, you've got to do it.
Yeah, well, they're here. They already came, and they're looking like they might have been 40% off flowers.
Just take the Dow Jones sticker off them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
They're behind a paywall. no, they're beautiful flowers. We'll see. I just, you know, she doesn't have to know this, of course. You know, so let's keep it between us.
She clearly doesn't listen to your podcast.
I want to ask. Oh, the day my wife listens to my podcast, that's just not going to happen. I want to ask you about this interesting, you know, midlife or mid-career transition you're making here, because you've been a baseball writer for a long time. You're a beat baseball writer for several years, a baseball columnist covering the game nationally. And while you continue to do that, you're also branching off into the world of golf. And, you know, it's always very interesting to talk to a sports writer who knows one sport really, really well and then, you know, obviously switches to an environment. And, like, I mean, are they completely asymmetrical, or are there ways in which they're similar, or is the sort of change of it really stimulating and interesting?
No, you know, they're very similar. I get a lot of the same kinds of readers. They tend to read the print newspaper and or tend to be over the age of 70. And both sports get the same reaction from millennials who really have no idea what I'm talking about either way. So they're sort of equally befuddled as to why I'm wasting their time with these strange old stick and ball sports articles.
I guess it is. You're staying in stick and ball, so it's not that much of a venture.
Right. Like if it wasn't stick and ball, I don't know if mentally I could handle it. You know what I mean? Because there's a ball and a stick, I think. I'll see if I can figure it out.
One thing that, and you've managed to figure out ways to do this already in a really impressive way, but, you know, there's not the kind of media obligation to golf that baseball has. You know, you were obviously allowed when you were covering major leagues to spend time in the locker room before games, after games. And while that's not exactly, you know, an intimate environment, you know, you do develop a rapport with players over time. And golf doesn't, because it's so migrant and because the media obligations are fewer.
Yeah.
You don't have that kind of thing. And does that make it a little challenging?
It does. I mean, baseball is great in the sense that they have preserved a lot of media access. And you're not even just, you know, requesting interviews, just the chance to sort of physically be present in a space with these guys where you can interact with people in a more informal way and get to know them a little bit and just kind of chat them up and get ideas. With golfers, you know, it's a very different dynamic. They'll do a certain number of sort of, you know, press conferences and sort of group gaggles and things like that that they're required to do. But otherwise, it's just a different sort of dynamic. So, yeah, that's definitely something I'm still trying to sort of navigate and figure out.
I know you play some golf. You and I have played before. Do you feel a professional obligation to play a little bit more, to be more connected to the game yourself?
I do. I absolutely do. Because, you know, it's funny, like, golf is a kind of sport where you talk to sources and they immediately want to know, like, you know, do you play? Like, you know, like, are you one of us or what? You know what I mean?
Oh,
whereas, like,
funny, really.
With baseball players, are not like, yeah. Hey, you know, do you play ball on the weekend?
Do you
like,
pitch?
No,
that's
right. Nobody cares. So I would like to get my game up to a semi-respectable level,
yeah.
As much as one could do while living in Manhattan and having a young child.
Have you? Yes, which is probably harder than winning a World Series.
Right.
Have you had any circumstances where you've been talking to a source and they've said some sort of golf jargon where you've kind of nodded your head but secretly been, I have no idea what that person is talking about?
I think I still do it in baseball sometimes too. Yeah, every now and then, like, I think it's probably true for reporters that cover any industry. Like, you know, no matter how well you think you know it, you'll be talking to someone and they'll just, like, you know, throw out a term casually, like, of course, of course. And,
yeah.
You know, there are times when I stop and ask, like, wait, what? But there are totally been times in anything where it's baseball or golf where somebody will throw out a word like that and I'll just be like, absolutely. And I'll be like, Google, type.
I actually had to Google yesterday shank because I wasn't exactly sure what a shank was. I mean, I've heard it 1,000 times, but I didn't actually understand that it is hitting the ball with something other than the club face. Like that's officially a shank.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that was like the official term. I would have thought of shank as just like, you know, when I take a swing and really just get it like on the sort of real end of the club, so it like, you know, goes really short and really wide right or something, where it's like, you know,
it's a shot that can kill somebody, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. But I did not know that would, you technically have to miss the club face.
That's the technical term for it. But believe me, I can shank it while hitting it on the club face, too. Brian, I want to ask you about your story this week with regard to shorts on the tour. And I feel like this has been out there for a while, this conversation. And is there any sense that we're reaching some sort of tipping point where we could actually see this happen? And what I'm saying is that golf for a long time has, and forgive me, is it, do they specifically prohibit it, or is it just sort of a cultural norm of it that they don't wear shorts?
No, if you're on the PGA Tour and you're out there, whether it's a Tuesday or a Sunday, you're at the tournament site on the course. You have to wear pants.
Okay, so practice
so
round.
Just
nobody around. You can't wear shorts.
Exactly. Now, if you're home on your country club, or you know, you do what you want when you're not there. But you know, when you show up at the tournament site that week, whether it's a practice round or a competition round, you have to wear pants. And what changed recently was really just what the European Tour did. I mean, wouldn't be discussed right now as it's been if it weren't for the fact that the European golf tour, which is separate from the PGA Tour,
sure.
Has a new CEO who's sort of progressive-minded and has been attacking other issues like slow play. And well, shorts was not really an item on the agenda. It was just one of those things where last month there was a tournament in Malaysia, which I've never been there, but it sounds quite sweaty to be out playing in Malaysia. And these guys were like, you know, dude, please, can we just like put on shorts just for the practice rounds, please?
Yeah.
And they let them do it. And that just very quickly, the European Tour was like, you know what? Well, let's just let you guys do that in general for practice rounds only. And so that was a big change because although it's seemingly like, who cares? It's a small thing. You know, golf really hadn't moved in that direction before. So it was sort of a pointless conversation until you start to see one tour showing an openness toward players bearing those legs.
Now, what is the argument against it?
I think the argument against it is that, you know, it's not professional. It's not the, you know, the look.
You wouldn't wear shorts to work.
Right. It's not the look of the professional golfer, the professional golf has looked to put out there, which I sort of immediately dismissed as like, oh, stuffy old golf, you know, like being tightwads. I actually have sort of come around on the idea that at least in competition rounds, it has some value. And I was talking to Hunter Mahan, a golfer who I think put it very well and said, you know, other sports have uniforms.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like our uniform out there. That's kind of how you, like, you know, you're looking at not an ordinary golfer. You're looking at a pro. And so when you put it that way, I was kind of like, okay, you know, it's not just stodginess. It's the idea that, you know, the pro golfer should look in some way exceptional, not just in what they do athletically, but in appearance. So I could see it a little bit more with that argument.
Well, and also, you know, there, it's not as if golf has not sort of modified its clothing over the years and become more casual with the times. If you were to go back and look at Bobby Jones, they'd look at players today and think they're a bunch of slobs.
Oh, completely. I mean, those guys would be rolling over looking at, you know, Ricky Fowler and high tops. I mean, they didn't even know what high top was then. But, yeah, I mean, they've it's moved much more casual within the constraints that exist with regard to pants. So on the one hand, it seems kind of silly to keep the pants rule when you've got, you know, a lot of room, wiggle room elsewhere. I could also see the idea of saying, you know, we like the look of the pro that it gives. And I also don't know that, like, you know, part of the argument I think people have made is like, but you've got to be kind of younger and hipper, right? Like, if you're going to attract, like, someone other than old white men to the sport, to watching the sport and following it and really, you know, broaden the audience that, you know, be young and hip and not old and stodgy. But, like, I think you could also argue, like, wait a second, are more kids going to watch the PGA, you know, the Farmers Insurance Open on Sunday because someone is in shorts and not pants?
Like the mother coming onto the porch. Kids, they're in shorts. And all the kids, like, run in from the yard.
We can see their legs.
But isn't there, you know, there's sort of two facets of this, of course. It's one, it's sort of responding to what your players want. You know, that's the what's appears to have happened in Europe. But also, you know, being somewhat in sync with what your playing public is doing. And, you know, at a great many, you know, golf courses around the country from May until September, what you see are players in shorts. And, you know, is that a compelling reason to make the change? Is there a sort of broader... Is it strictly right now the conversation happening among players, or is it there also this broader issue at play, which is, you know, making golf, you know, it just you know, increasing the sort of connective tissue between the everyday player or the casual player and the professional tour?
Yeah, well, the you know, the casual player is already there with shorts. I mean, even a lot of the old country clubs. I think this is like a microcosm of a larger issue in question, like the PGA Tour always faces, which is like, to what extent is it responsible for, like, you know, leading the way for the casual golfer? You know, that comes up a lot in pace of play. You know, one of the biggest problems driving people away from golf right now is it's slow. It takes a really long time, and it's slower than it needs to be. And like the pros are like the worst examples of this. I mean, they stand over a putt for a minute. The rounds take longer than they need to. And the PGA Tour really hasn't done much to try to change that. And you could argue that golf in general would be better off if they did, because it would you know, sort of lead the way for the casual player. But I think that their mentality is, no, like, you know, this is a player's tour, and if we're all competitors and want to take the time we think we need to hit our shots, so we're going to take the time we think we need.
Brian, it just occurred to me, I can't believe I asked you that if there are huge differences between baseball and golf, because we're right back here at baseball, too. This is pace of play was the primary issue in baseball when you were writing about that.
Yeah, yeah, there are a lot of similarities for sure.
I had a dinner not long ago where I sat next to a guy who used to be a caddy in Europe, and he was making an argument, and I'm curious to get your reaction to it. He's been around golf his entire life, and he feels that what happened with golf was in the 90s, when you had sort of the Tiger Woods phenomenon really taking off, that people thought that golf's growth was going to somehow mirror the economy. And that, in fact, really happened. You saw this remarkable growth of new courses and new players of the game who were driven, and then it just did not sustain itself. And so golf is kind of pulling back from that. And that the proper place for golf is a smaller, he didn't want to say a niche sport, because it's not, it's a little bigger than a niche sport, but, you know, it's never going to compete with football or basketball or even hockey, that it's going to be a smaller thing, and that golf should preserve and fight to preserve the things that have made it kind of idiosyncratic. And, he doesn't like the idea of 15-inch holes or, accelerated play or, allowing cell phones on the course. He likes the rulesy aspect of golf. I mean, and he thinks that that's something that makes it distinct and should be cherished rather than stripped away.
Yeah, I think it's a really hard balancing act for the sport to try to figure out right now. I mean, it's not really smart to go too far in either extreme, right? I mean, you don't want to close yourself off to people who might be interested in being really good, serious golfers if only maybe you let them listen to music on their earphones when they play. But like if you get so goofy to the point where the risk in doing too much of the new innovative, like the 15-inch holes, bigger balls, all these ideas, which I love, is that that doesn't really actually attract that many new people to the game.
Yes.
And you just like change what the game is for the people who are your avid big spending people who really drive the sport right
yes.
now. And that's the thing, like these ideas are great, but at the end of the day, if they don't go from cool idea to actually working and bringing people in,
right,
then it's not worth the fuss, really.
I mean, as a very casual golfer and someone who plays, if I'm lucky, a couple times a week during the summertime, if I'm really lucky, it seems to me there are sort of two issues here. One is that I don't think it's just an issue of sort of the collapse of the, mid-90s, growth of golf. I think that the big clubs, with the exceptions of some of the greatest ones and some of the real golf hotbeds around the country in the South and the Southwest, California and so on, I don't think they're worrying about the growth of golf in like abandoned dunes. But I do feel that your average run-of-the-mill golf club in America is sort of struggling a little bit to grow a membership. And if it's not a question of having slow Saturdays, they're at least looking at the clientele that they have and saying, well, these guys are going to start dying off soon, and where do we go from there?
Right.
And so that's a real thing. And then the second thing that I just think fundamentally is people just have less time. It's the cultural change of fathers saying, hey, see you kids, this afternoon, and
yeah,
taking off for 6 hours. That just, people don't live lives like that anymore,
yeah,
it seems.
But I don't know. Like, I grew up, 80s, 90s. Like, did we really live lives like that in the 90s either? Like, I don't,
my father, he wasn't a golfer, but he was a tennis player and then became a golfer later in his life. He was that guy walking out at 7:30 in the morning, like, see you kids.
Right, right.
And then see him at the barbecue at 6.
Well, the husband and wife both working and trying to raise kids, that is something I think is a change that, and I know, in my case too, totally,
yes,
plays into that.
I played 18 holes not that long ago when I was in Arizona for the college football championship, and I was exhausted by the end of it. I just can't handle it. Like, it's like too much to ask. 9 holes seems perfect to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Shorter form golf makes sense because you're not really changing the game. You're just changing this idea that it has to be 5 hours or nothing.
I want to ask you about your trip to Top Golf, because you played at Top Golf. You were in Arizona yourself not that long ago, and I visited Top Golf, which is this glamorous new driving range company, which is, going after the younger golf consumer. And it's almost like a nightclub. It's like, imagine your favorite, driving range, the seedy little driving range of your childhood, sexed up and with chicken fingers and tequila and all that kind of stuff. And what'd you think?
It was fun. It was funny when I walked in and I was asking them some questions. They're like, "Well, we're not a driving range. Don't call us a driving range. I don't know what they call themselves. Other just
we're a golf experience,
right?" it was fun. It reminded me of bowling alleys we have in New York City that are kind of turned into like bar, club hangouts. I think it's great. The driving range is something that is always this very solitary experience. You may play golf on a twosome or a foursome, but whenever you go to the range, you're always kind of alone. Top Golf kind of turns it into a social experience where you can sort of play these little games, aiming for certain targets, trying to score points against the guy you're with, or,
It's not for the, four handicap guy who wants to go hit 350 balls, right?
No. Although it's funny because I think it attracts a mix. Like, you can bring your own clubs and be really serious about it and like trying to work on your game, or you could just use the clubs they have there and be terrible and kind of have a good time with it.
Did you play against anybody or were you solo?
No, I was by myself, which was funny. They all kind of looked at me like, what's your deal exactly?
Because, who's the sad man?
most people were there. I think they have these little pods basically that fit like up to six people, I think it is.
Yeah.
So it is definitely more of a social experience than it was for me.
Yeah.
But I had fun. I actually hadn't been to the driving range in a while. It measures how far you hit the ball, and there's some cool things about it that
are
actually
chipped,
very
so,
applicable to like trying to work on your game. So it's not totally like, you know, a goofy thing.
No, not at all. And yeah, you could definitely get something out of it. It's pricey though. It is.
I think the nighttime hours. Yeah. It's like $45. It was $45 an hour for. But you could split, if you're with a group though, you could split that. So, definitely go with more than one person.
It's, you know, again, every sort of golf conversation has to be framed around the future of golf, but I enjoyed it. It's hard to sort of look at it and make the leap from, okay, you know, these people who are in their 20s and early 30s eating chicken fingers and having tequila shots are going to suddenly start migrating and playing 18 holes on the weekends. I just, you know, it feels like it's its own thing. I don't know if it is necessarily a pathway to a new golf generation.
It could be. I mean, that's the question with golf. Like, of course it's older. It's always been older. The question is always, will people pick it up as they get older and make a little bit more money? You know, baseball's a different conversation. It's like it was the sport of America's youth, and now it's not. And that the fact that it was the sport of America's youth is largely what made it America's pastime. Golf has never been something like, oh, yeah, back when we were kids, we just whacked the ball around the yard. Like, no, it's always been something that, you know, kids get into it, but and they have done more now. They have their first tee program and things like that. But it's always something that I think that, you know, is really driven by people as they get older playing more as they get older.
Sure, and you want that solitude and you want that kind of escape. But it did have sort of this baked in, you know, youth culture in that I'm old enough that I caddied, you know, and a lot of my friends caddied, and caddy culture was a big thing. You know, most clubs had caddies and it was an easy way to make money. I mean, I wanted to be a caddy because I heard it was, you know, a good summer job.
Yeah.
And caddies are hard to find. It doesn't really exist anymore. And I can't help but feel you're sort of cutting out a little bit of that, you know, youth through that. Not that it was a pipeline, but it was at least an introduction to the sport.
Well, it works both ways, right? Theoretically, if you cut out caddies, you're also cutting out some of the cost, which also maybe makes the sport more accessible to people.
Yes.
So, you know, golf, there are about 25 million golfers in the U.S. That number has actually kind of been flat for the last you know, a few years. So now it's just a question of, you know, is it going to grow by how much, or is it kind of going to stay where it is? But I don't see it like totally collapsing.
I think it's very funny whenever I have a conversation with someone who is a very serious, you know, casual weekend golfer, and you talk about, you know, golf courses being less crowded, they're like, good, you know, more, more time for me. What's to complain about?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want it to become more popular. What are you talking about? Like, I want to whip around the course. So it is an interesting thing. Well, Brian, what's the next big tournament, of course, is, well, we have Pebble Pro-Am this weekend. It doesn't sound like you're participating in that this weekend.
Well, I'll make it quick because the lights is actually went out in the studio here. So I don't know if this podcast is paying its bills. Oh, there we go. Pebble Beach is this weekend.
But that's a goof, right?
That's the celebrity thing that has a long history on the tour. Next week, Riviera in L.A., Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth will both be there, so that'll be interesting. And then
that's a lot of celebrities at that one, too.
Right. And then the next week starts the Florida Swing, which is sort of the unofficial like countdown to the Masters starting after that point.
Are you getting tingly for the Masters and the Jordan Spieth repeat?
CBS keeps working in those little 5-second promos with the, you know, the trees and the flowers and the music, and I just go, oh.
Awesome. Hey, Brian, thanks so much for joining us. That's Brian Costa, Wall Street Journal sports columnist. You can read him on baseball and golf and many other things in the Wall Street Journal. This has been the Free For All. Thanks so much to our guests, Mara Gay and Brian Costa and Ben Cohen in Toronto. And join us next week for more.